You know, it doesn't seem a day goes by lately where the FBI, one of the most revered law enforcement agencies in the world, is being targeted, is being smeared by politicians. It's got to stop. My next guest, James Davidson, a former FBI agent, is doing something about it. You're going to love this show. Next on the CJ Evolution Podcast. Hello, everybody. Patrick here. Thank you for tuning into the show. We continue to grow, folks, because of you, the listener and supporter. Thank you so much. Big shout out to all those brave men and women who work in law enforcement, whatever level, federal, state, local. Thank you for doing a very difficult job in a very difficult environment. Keep up the great work. I am so excited to be part of WMAP Radio, folks. You're going to love the show. Head over to WMAPradio.com and you can listen to me. It's an East Coast radio station hosted by Casey Armstrong, an amazing guy, amazing host. You're going to love the show. I'm on weeknights, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Head over to WMAPradio.com. There are so many threats out there these days, folks, when it comes to drugs, explosives that expose our first responders, our brave men and women out there protecting us every day. Thank God for Detecticam. This amazing company is putting mobile threat detection in the palm of the first responders' hand, specifically for explosive residues and all kinds of drugs out there that can harm, again, our first responders. Head over to cjevolution.com. You're going to see a link to Detecticam and see what this amazing company can do for your organization. Again, folks, you're going to love this upcoming guest. I give you James Davidson, president of Protect the FBI. Enjoy the show. Hello, everybody. So excited to have my next guest, James Davidson. Jim Davidson on the show. Jim, are you there, sir?
I am. Patrick, thank you for having me on the show.
Well, thank you so much. You spent a lot of the years, thank you for your service to the FBI, Jim. We all appreciate it. Thank you for your service. And can you talk about, well, first of all, let me back up. What was the catalyst? What was the reason you got into law enforcement, sir?
I'll tell you what, I was about 7 or 8 years old, and I started writing NASA for photographs and pictures. And
Oh, cool.
I originally, believe it or not, I wanted to be an astronaut. As time moved forward and I realized that my my ability in algebra and physics was going to be somewhat limited, I kind of forgot about public service for a while. But I ended up going to school in Washington, D.C. And at some point during my time there, I went down to the FBI building and I went on their tour. And I thought that this was interesting. And I think, my family was probably in visiting from New Jersey. I grew up in New Jersey. I just thought it would be an interesting career path. My major at the time was accounting. I was happy to learn from one of the tour guides that, the FBI was hiring accountants and attorneys. This was way before. I'm not even sure that the word cybersecurity was in the lexicon at the time. You know, this goes back to the late 80s or, the mid 80s, actually. Uh-huh. I graduated. I went into accounting. I went to work for Deloitte & Touche at the time, one of the big six accounting firms. And then I think at some point I went to work for Kidder Peabody as an analyst. I went to their analyst program, and I'd forgotten about public service, but somewhere between those two jobs, I actually went to work for a small startup company that was producing job fairs. And one of the leads I had was to actually call the FBI and see if they wanted to buy a booth at the job fair. And what this concept was that they were going to essentially invite the top students from the top Northeastern universities, from the Ivy Leagues and the Michigans and some of those schools. And then they were going to bring in the top companies, the Fortune 500 companies, but they also wanted to bring in the three-letter agencies. So I had a call with a recruiter from the FBI, and we ended up talking for the better part of an hour. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, he says, it's been great to talk to you. He goes, to be quite honest, we really don't go to job fairs. It's just not one of the things that we do. They do now. They didn't do it then. But you have a very interesting background. And although you weren't quite able to sell me, give me a few minutes. I want to sell you. And I don't know if he got to the, you know, the 10th word. I was sold. Yeah. My kind of dreams of public service had reemerged, and within about a year and a half, I was actually at the FBI Academy going through the training.
And it takes a long time. I don't know. So it took you a year. And is that normal? The amount of time it comes from you go to Quantico, right?
We go to, yeah. It takes at least a year for most people. And the first 6 months, and I still wasn't sure. I had to talk to my family. I went to the New York Public Library. This is before the internet, or just maybe at the start of the internet. I'm not even sure the word internet was in the lexicon at the time. So I went to the New York Public Library and I started doing some research, and I kind of talked to some different people for about 6 months. And then all of a sudden it just clicked. And I knew that this was the job that I wanted. The next 6 months was probably the most excruciating the time of my life, waiting to see whether I had already taken the fit test. I had gone through, you know, the interviews, and this was right around the time of the first Gulf War. I remember actually sitting in the bullpen at Kidd or Peabody, getting a call from the FBI recruiter. And doing one of those, I hate this, it's a little bit embarrassing, one of those working girl, you know, like this wide pan across the bullpen. I threw my arms up in the air. I'm like, yes! And I went in and told my boss, who we had developed a good relationship, by that time. And I said, look, this is about the only thing in the world that could bring me to disappoint you. He was... The firm, the company was fully supportive. Yeah. And if the analysts generally, the best ones, are maybe right 60% of the time. I felt that being an FBI agent, maybe I can be right 95% of the time. Of course, I lost my first case in the FBI, but that's a whole other story. So
now, like you said, Jim, the FBI back in the day, they wanted lawyers and accountants. Now you can have a degree. You have to have a bachelor's at least, but now it can be in any discipline, correct?
It could be in any discipline then as well. But there was still kind of a holdover, maybe going back to the Hoover era, that it was mostly attorneys, mostly accountants. They were starting to look at language quite a bit at the time. They wanted to see anyone that spoke Chinese Mandarin or Spanish, especially Spanish. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a whole lot of talk about Arabic at the time. Of course, now if you speak Arabic, if you're fluent in Arabic, you can write your ticket with the FBI. And of course, now cyber is a important background as well. But no, at the time, it was mostly accountants and attorneys, a lot of former military, a lot of former cops. Just in so many ways, just one of the most diverse group of people in the FBI. From creative backgrounds, you know, my best friend in the FBI, who actually rose to be the number four guy in the FBI, was an accomplished guitarist, wrote his own music.
Wow.
People would be shocked. You look around, FBI agents, FBI professionals, whether they're agents or scientists or technicians, they're a reflection of society.
And the FBI was instrumental. They were the pioneers, and they're the ones that created, correct me if I'm wrong, the behavioral sciences unit, you know, the profiling division of the FBI, correct?
I believe that they certainly were pioneers. It's funny because NYP and LAPD are also at the forefront of a variety of things in law enforcement. In terms of police agencies. I can't say my guess is that the FBI was at the forefront of profiling and the behavioral analysis unit. And LAPD may have figured into that at some point, but I'm not sure. I could be wrong. So.
Now, how many agents, are encompass the FBI, Jim?
It's about 13 or 14,000. out of about 35,000 employees. Only about 13,000 or so are actually FBI agents, or special agents, as the public knows them.
And they're all over the country, right? In major cities, they have, you know, SACs and or special agents in charge of in
they're actually all over the world.
All over the world.
So,
okay.
Yeah, there's about 60. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me. There's about 60 field offices, you know, in the major statistical metropolitan areas. And then I think there's about 60 embassies that covering most of the world. So you could be in an embassy in, well, let's say, Ukraine, where I was for a period of time, and we covered Belarus. You can be in a very close friend of mine. In fact, he's on the board of Protect the FBI, which, of course, we're going to talk about in a few minutes. He was the legal attaché in Bridgetown, Barbados, and he covered most of the Caribbean, or at least most of the Eastern Caribbean. I think 60 islands, 60 countries. So it's, but we have people all over the world. But of course, we're mostly known as a domestic law enforcement and counterterrorism, counterintelligence agency.
Yeah, but if there's an attack on an American citizen abroad, the FBI has jurisdiction, correct?
They do.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, let's shift gears a little bit and let's talk about it. It's a perfect segue into what we what I want to ask you about. Tell us about Protect the FBI.
I would love to. So, let me start with Protect the FBI's mission, let me stress over all else that it is a nonpartisan mission, a nonpartisan organization. We're composed of former FBI professionals, its agents, scientists, engineers, IT professionals, analysts, and also composed of private citizens, so former FBI professionals and private citizens, whose mission is to safeguard the FBI and the U.S. intelligence community from partisan politics.
What was the catalyst behind starting this organization? You're the president, right, Jim?
I'm the president, yeah.
And it's a 501c4, correct?
It is. So 501c4 is a social welfare organization, and it allows us to do a number of different things. It does not allow us to get involved in supporting a candidate for office or opposing a candidate for office, but it does allow us to do unlimited lobbying. So we can lobby Congress and we can do a number of other things to promote the social welfare.
And it seems like, and I know you know this, but for the listener out there, the FBI has been in, I don't want to say it seems like, it is true, the FBI has been in the spotlight over the last handful of years.
They've, of course, always been in the spotlight, but since 2016 is, I think, probably what you're about to refer to. So.
Yeah. Well, and I think the FBI is getting such such a bad rap. I mean, it's being used as a political weapon, right?
It is, and that's the purpose. That is why Protect the FBI is here. That's what brought my former colleagues and I and Americans from all political persuasions together to get involved in this organization. So
what exactly? I know you said the purpose and the mission of it, but so what does the organization do on a, if you could just walk us through a typical day, Protect the FBI, Jim?
Sure. Let me do that. Well, right now, the genesis of the organization goes back to about 2016, and we all just kind of got tired of the FBI taking it in the teeth, so to speak. I mean, there was a number of high-level controversies in the FBI that, very, very clearly began to cause a significant loss of public trust by Americans across the political spectrum. So I've talked to people from all over the country, left, right, and center, at coffee shops, when traveling, when doing speaking engagements. And the most common perception, regardless of your politics, is that the agency had been or will be politicized to one extent or the other by one party or the other. And that really was the catalyst, the main, issue that we wanted to address, because we know FBI agents, we know what their sentiments are. We know how they think. We know that, you know, if you get 100 FBI agents in a room or FBI professionals in a room, you're going to get 100 different opinions about the exact same thing. First and foremost, you know, I'm not going to talk about the past or any specific event in the past. You know, we are a forward-looking organization. You know, we have no opinion about the events of the recent past. You know, we don't assign blame. In fact, assigning blame is divisive, and our purpose here is to unite. So, you know, we have former FBI agents, former FBI professionals from both sides of the political aisle, and many more who simply have no opinion about politics at all. But, you know, their opinions run the full spectrum. But the one thing that we all agree on, and this is what we've come together to do, and I'm going to talk about what we're going to do or what we plan to do in a few minutes, but we've all come together with the belief that the FBI is actually vulnerable to being politicized. Mm-hmm. Regardless of whether you think it has been or not, it is vulnerable in the future to being politicized. And in fact, you know, you only need to look back as far as the Watergate era when Al Patrick Gray was FBI director to see that it's possible. So,
why is that, Jim? You hardly ever hear. Why is the FBI taking it in the teeth all the time? There's ATF. There's, you know, I think Customs and Border Patrol's been in the news a lot. But CIA. I mean, it just seems like the brunt of all this just falls on the FBI's shoulder, and that's unfair. You know, I just always wondered why the FBI is getting this all the time. And it's not spread out among it. I mean, like this, I'm not trying to pick on other agencies, but it just seems like the FBI is constantly the target.
First of all, in terms of other agencies, I actually was assigned to work with DEA for mm-hmm. a period of time. And I cut my teeth over there learning how to write wiretaps and how to do a number of different things. I work with a brilliant DEA agent that probably taught me more in the year that I worked with him than anybody else taught me. I also worked with Customs, particularly overseas, and I've got some close friends in IRS, CID. But there's a mysticism behind the FBI that obviously goes back, you can credit no matter what you think of it, you credit J. Edgar Hoover for building the agency into what it is today, and the mysticism and the wide range of responsibilities that we have, you know, from counterterrorism to counterintelligence to violent crime to crimes against children to just so many different purposes and functions. In fact, we do so many different things, and the public has so little such a little understanding of so many of the things that we do that sometimes just the lack of understanding about some of the things we do creates a perception that we're doing things wrong or that we should have done things, you know, that we shouldn't have knocked on a door at 6 a.m. or gone in guns blazing. And there's a lack of understanding, and I mean, it's understandable. And that's, you know, one of the reasons that we're here is to, you know, we have a forum actually on our website, Ask a Former FBI Agent, and you can ask any question you want either there or on our Facebook page. If one of our guys, one of our members can't answer the question right away, we will go out and get an answer for you, because there is no one person that is an expert on the FBI in terms of everything it does. Yeah. You know, I spent 23 years and I couldn't speak, I couldn't speak extensively about our counterintelligence program because I never worked counterintelligence.
Sure.
You know, that's another thing that's kind of driving this confusion and the perception of politicization.
Well, and I can't,
just a lack of understanding.
So. And you mentioned cyber terrorism. I can't imagine how many threats there are that the FBI and other agencies thwart on a daily basis. I mean, it's got to be huge that the public doesn't know about, and they, you know, rightfully so, probably. But I mean, cyber terrorism alone is huge.
Yeah, cybersecurity is a
cyber or cybersecurity cyber too. Security, yeah,
cybersecurity. We just actually had a former FBI agent who was a cybersecurity expert, In fact, I think he spent about 11 or 12 years in the FBI and then decided to go in the private sector. But he just joined and is going to be on our congressional liaison team, and is very fluent understanding in what the FBI does really well, and actually what the FBI could do better in cybersecurity. He understands very robustly the relationship between the FBI and the private sector and where that relationship needs to be improved, and how, you know, even the private sector is to some extent is a little gun shy in some circumstances about working with the FBI, not necessarily because of the, you know, perception of the last 3 years, but for other reasons. So we're glad to have him on the board. And if anybody has a cybersecurity question, you know, he'll be the resource. Mm-hmm. So, the FBI does, I should clarify, they do cyber defense, as opposed to cyber offense.
Yeah.
We are a defensive agency. We defend our infrastructure from foreign threats.
And you didn't have to worry about this. I mean, it's just in terms of what the FBI does now, Jim, you alluded to it earlier. It's just has grown exponentially from the time you joined, right? I mean, with responsibilities and you know, things that the FBI does, right?
Yeah, it has. I think, you know, when I went through the academy, I think it was 4 weeks, and I think that they're up to at least, almost 4 months, maybe 3.5 months, and I think they're pretty close to 5 months now. So there's there's so many more disciplines to learn and so much more to know about the world. The world's become, you know, it's become much, much more complex. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, I think I'm glad to be, protect the FBI. It's not easy getting a social welfare organization off the ground,
sure.
But it's a lot harder being an FBI employee, that's for sure.
Now, how is recruitment now with some of the publicity in the last couple of years? Is recruitment waned, or is there still a strong desire for young men and women to go into the FBI?
It's robust. I mean, people see through what's going on. They understand the mission. The FBI is, the FBI doesn't go out there and defend itself. And quite frankly, it's not protect the FBI's job to go out there and defend the FBI. Our job is to safeguard the FBI from partisan politics.
Sure.
And occasionally that will mean and does mean looking at FBI policy and other occasionally cultural issues that we think make the FBI vulnerable or would make the FBI vulnerable, but they don't really have to defend themselves. They just do what they do. You know, the mindset of an FBI employee is that no man is above the law, and that is the driving force. It's important for the public to understand that the FBI employees are just like them. They're their neighbors. We have the full range of opinions on a full range of topics, but at the end of the day, they are there to safeguard the country from, as we say, threats, both foreign and domestic.
Mm-hmm. Brave men and women. And you spent many years in law enforcement, albeit the federal level, but still many years. You have, I'm assuming, Jim, you have many friends that are municipal officers and municipal law or state law enforcement agencies. What do you think some of the challenges for law enforcement? What do you think some of the challenges are going to be in the future?
Well, you know, we live in an environment. So there's good and bad. So we live in an environment where, you know, everything is recorded and put on social media. You know, before a police officer can even get home. Mm-hmm. You know, before his shift is over. So, and oftentimes, the portrayal is unfair, and often the portrayal actually is fair. You know, I don't have any specific instance in my mind, but it's a good and a bad thing. It's a check and balance I think it's in many ways is connected to an effort by local law enforcement and the FBI in general to make a point to establish a liaison with the community. I see this with LAPD. I'm based in Los Angeles. And I see this with LAPD. I see it on the news all the time. There's an effort to get involved in the civic basketball leagues and to reach out to these kids that might otherwise join gangs and to let them see that the police officers that are, you know, protecting them, that are patrolling their neighborhoods, are very much like them, and ensuring that they can relate to each other, and I think in some ways that effort is driven, you know, by the world that we live in, you know, we live in a very connected world right now, and you can, you know, social media is an amazing thing. It's a force for. I can't say that I'm thrilled with every aspect of social media, but. I long for a world, you know, I think that I was, people tell me sometimes that I was born in the wrong era, that I was, I probably should have turned 18 in about 1955, but, I think that the social media is ultimately, going to bring a driver of a change to law enforcement, but change, change for the better.
So. Yeah. And I think change is good. And I think. I remember when we first went to body cams in my agency, and I don't have a problem with body cams personally. I think it helps law enforcement in a lot of ways. But yeah, technology is driving, law enforcement. That's one of the drives with law enforcement. And I think ultimately it's going to make us more account. At least I hope it makes us more accountable, and we're able to do our jobs better.
It does. I was actually trying to be as diplomatic as I could be, but I was going to stay away from body cams because it's I know that among police officers, it's a difficult thing to
sure.
That your every move is going to, because you worry still about, little, I maybe for lack of a better word, snippets are going to appear and portray you the wrong way, but ultimately these things will all work themselves out, and I think that law enforcement in general is growing more enmeshed with the communities that they serve, and I think that's a good thing.
So. Well, Jim Davidson, thank you so much, sir. I mean, if people want to reach out to you and to find the organization Protect the FBI, how can they do that, sir?
Well, we've got a website. It's protecttheFBI.org, and the website will talk about a few of the problems that we see, and then they'll go into just some of the solutions. But let me just talk about one, solution right now. One of the things that, in fact, it's the main thing that we're doing, and we think it's kind of the greatest common denominator. It's Congress. We as an organization believe that the hyper-partisanship in Congress right now, when it comes to national security, is actually making the FBI and the USIC. The USIC is the United States Intelligence Community, mostly the three-letter agencies, the NSA, the CIA, the FBI, other elements of the U.S. government. But this hyper-partisanship is making the FBI not only vulnerable to false accusations of partisanship, but is actually making the FBI and the USIC susceptible to the possibility of being politicized by one party or the other in the future. So, in short, we believe that this hyper-partisanship on national security issues actually creates the conditions for the FBI to be used as a political, football or as a punching bag. So. We're looking at FBI policy a little bit, but that's on the back burner for now. So, in terms of Congress, we are looking back to the days when actually a guy named Mike Rogers, a Republican from Michigan, who was in Congress from, I think, 2001 to about 2015, and Mike Rogers approached his Democrat counterpart, Dutch Ruppersberger from Maryland, who was the ranking member. So Rogers took over the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. That's the same committee that Nunez and Schiff are on. You see Nunez and Schiff on the news all the time, albeit separately, and that's one of our issues. But Mike Rogers went to Dutch Ruppersberger, and he said, listen, this is how I want to, when Rogers took over the committee, I think this was about 2011, he said, Dutch, what I want to do is I want to go on fact-finding missions together. This is national security. This is not breadbasket issues like healthcare or the economy. This is national security. I want to do fact finding together. I want to utilize database decision making. I want to make announcements together, meaning neither one of us will go in front of a camera or in front of a microphone unless we are standing next to each other.
Imagine that.
And we know what we're going to say.
Exactly. You don't see that anymore now. No, or you rarely see it.
Now, look, yeah, listen. They can disagree on the meaning and the relevance of facts. Obviously, there's going to be some daylight between what they may think on occasion those facts mean. But they're not going to issue separate reports. There might be one report with a majority opinion, but it's really unacceptable to us. I mean, you know, there's a Washington Post columnist, a novelist, David, I think his name is David, and I'm not going to sure I'm going to pronounce his last, David Ignatius, praised Mike Rogers for his approach to running this committee. Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat, praised Mike Rogers, a Republican, for his bipartisanship. And I think Mike Rogers, I don't know him personally, I think he now runs a bipartisan policy center.
Yeah.
So, but you contrast Rogers and Ruppersberger with Schiff and Nunez, you know, they both issued separate reports. Both reports omitted key facts and were designed to support the narrative that they wanted the public to believe. And that's just not accepted. It just shouldn't happen. Yeah. It shouldn't occur on any committee, but it absolutely should not occur on any committee with national security oversight. So what we are building right now is, and you'll see this on our website, again, protecttheFBI.org, you'll see that we are building our congressional liaison team, and we're adding former FBI professionals, agents, scientists, software engineers to the team at a pretty rapid pace now. And if you're happy, if you happen to be a former FBI professional or you know one, you know, just make sure that they know about this program. Mm-hmm. And if you're listening, please go to the website and apply, because there's 435 congressional districts. We'd like to have two for every district. But what we're going to ask our congressmen to do is we're going to ask them to take our pledge, which is also on the website. So it's a congressional pledge. And it is based on the motto of the FBI, which is fidelity, bravery, integrity. Now, I'm not gonna read the pledge to you, but I will tell you that in short, what we're asking Congress to do is to do all the things that Mike Rogers and Dutch Ruppersberger did when they ran that committee, but to do some of the things that in the Senate that Mark Warner and Richard Burr. Richard Burr is a Republican, the ranking member, and Mark Warner is a Democrat. Democrat actually is the ranking member because they're the minority, but the chairman is Richard Burr. We want they are an example of how things should be done in the House, and what we have no opinion on what they should decide. Only that they should make these decisions together. We want to see meaningful, rigorous, but bipartisan oversight of the FBI and the U.S. intelligence community.
Yeah.
And we think that this is that one issue that can actually bring, if they work together on national security, they can begin to work together on other issues. Yeah. And again, we have no particular opinion right now on what they should do specifically. We just want them to do this together. We want them to put country before party.
Yeah. And like you said, Jim, when everybody come or when but both sides, they're in their own camps issuing statements, that just promotes the divisiveness, right?
It promotes divisiveness. It's impossible to watch television and to actually know what to believe. Americans, and you know, we live in a free society and we're fairly secure in our democracy, so people don't pay close attention to the details of a Senate report, of the Mueller report. They don't have the time. They want to go and live their lives.
Sure.
They want to be able to trust their elected representatives to represent not their party, and not always just simply their district, but to actually represent and do what's best for the country. I think that in the next year to 2 to 3 years, pushing into 2020 and beyond, you're going to start to see the country not necessarily move towards the center in their political opinions, but there's going to be a push for at least some sort of moderation in how these parties, how both major parties interact with each other and how they approach decision making. I think people are going to want to see more data-based decision making, and, yeah. And they're going to want to see pragmatic solutions.
Yeah,
they're not going to want to see ideology rule the day, and that's you know, again, we have no opinion on the different breadbasket issues like, you know, the economy or healthcare. Mm-hmm. We're all about national security, and we are nonpartisan, and we are forward looking. But we think that this is a great place to start.
Well, Jim Davidson, thank you so much, sir. Keep doing amazing work, and we'll have everything linked up in the show notes. You know, protecttheFBI.org again, sir. Thank you for taking the time. Very informative, very educational. And good luck to you, sir. If you ever need anything, please reach out to me.
Patrick, we appreciate the invite, and we'll talk to you soon, offline for sure.
All right, buddy. Take care.